The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Cash hidden in a sofa and a president. In South Africa, there is talk of impeachment.
Politically, it's an incredibly tricky situation where our previous head of state had been under a cloud. And we now face a situation that this could be repeated.
Also today, President Biden welcomes French President Macron to the White House.
Our oldest ally, our unwavering partner in freedom's cause.
But the old allies have some tension to work through. I'm Marco Werman, plus journalists in El Salvador were noticing their phones were acting weird. They thought they were being hacked. Their fears were confirmed.
This was a moment of chilling confirmation, even for the ones who suspected it.
The executive editor hacked 42 times. Our guest, Ronan Farrow, explains. Coming up today, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Glad you could be with us today. A lot of news to get to. First up, the president of South Africa facing the possibility of impeachment. Cyril Ramaphosa came to office as an anti-corruption candidate. Now he's accused of violating the country's constitution, in part by covering up the theft of hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash, hidden in a sofa on his farm 2 years ago. Marianne Merton has been reporting on this story for South Africa's Daily Maverick. She joins us from Cape Town. Marianne, this is a huge story in South Africa, but for those of us who have not been following the various turns of the story, help us with some background. Cyril Ramaphosa is accused of covering up a theft at his Palapala farm. What was the theft and what was the cover-up?
The story, so to speak, actually kicks off Christmas 2019. A Sudanese businessman arrived at Palapala farm in Limpopo, bought 20 buffalo and paid for them with $580,000 in cash. That money was not put in a safe. It was put in cushions on a sofa in a disused bedroom, and that's where it stayed until February 2020, when the break-in happened and the theft of that foreign exchange money happened. We only heard and we only got to know about all of these events just a few months ago.
So this past June, details began to come out that Ramaphosa had started up a secret private investigation after the money was stolen from his Falafala farm. But it's been alleged that investigation is a cover-up. Explain.
It's not quite as simple. Parliament, our national legislature, has started a process to look into Ramaphosa's conduct in office. We call it a Section 89 impeachment motion in terms of our constitution. And one of the first steps as part of this impeachment process is the Section 89 panel. That panel got input from everyone, including the president, and that panel report and its recommendations was made public on Wednesday. That literally let the cat out of the bag.
And what was revealed in that report?
What was revealed in that report is a recommendation to pursue in the national legislature impeachment proceedings against President Ramaphosa on one of the grounds that you mentioned, covering up or not fully openly investigating the 2020 February theft of all of that forex money from the presidentially owned Palapala farm. It was one of the grounds that the Section 89 panel cited as serious violations of the Constitution. There were others, for example, the president exposing himself to a conflict of interest over his interests in this game and cattle farm, and also for paid outside work aside from his duties as South Africa's president.
President Cyril Ramaphosa came to office following Jacob Zuma, who had his own scandals. Ramaphosa vowed, though, to fight corruption. How is he seen now politically?
It's an incredibly tense time at the moment. I think since the Section 89 panel report came out, certainly President Ramaphosa, for example, cancelled an appearance in the other House of Parliament, the National Council of Provinces. The speculation currently is very rife that he would resign even. And what we do know is that the National Executive Committee of the governing ANC, it was meant to meet tonight. It will now meet in person tomorrow. And those are crucial steps and crucial discussion points that will direct what will happen to President Ramaphosa. Look, he could resign. He could say, no, I'm not. I'm going to tough it out. I'm going to face it. He did tell the Section 89 panel in his statement to it that he had done nothing wrong and that, quote, I have endeavored throughout my tenure as president not only to abide by my oath, but to set an example of respect for the Constitution, for its institutions, for due process and the law, unquote. And that certainly has been his message, and it kind of chimes with the kind of anti-corruption presidency that he sought to establish.
Uncharted but troubling waters. Marianne Merton reports for South Africa's Daily Maverick, explaining the political fortunes of President Cyril Ramaphosa, who could be facing impeachment. Marianne, thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care.
Today, European leaders appear close to an agreement to put a price cap on Russian oil. It's the latest attempt to try and starve Russian President Vladimir Putin of revenues needed to pay for his war in Ukraine. The World's Carolyn Beeler joins me. Carolyn, first of all, the basics. What is a price cap?
So European countries themselves will stop buying most Russian crude oil on Monday, but they want other countries to be able to continue to buy it so that global oil prices don't go totally through the roof. As you said, though, this is an economic weapon of war, so they're devising a price cap.
So how exactly is this going to work?
The idea is that oil tankers and insurers, most of which are based in the EU and UK, will still be allowed to ship crude oil to non-EU countries if they stick to this price cap. So EU leaders have been haggling over what exactly that price cap will be, and today appeared poised in Brussels, according to multiple news outlets, to agree to a cap of $60 a barrel.
Carolyn, just how much of an impact is this expected to have on Russian revenues?
Well, oil and gas revenues are hugely important to Russia. Since 2006, they've made up about 40% of the Russian federal budget, but it's unclear how much this price cap might cut into those earnings. The $60 a barrel is actually not too much lower than where Russian oil has been trading recently, so it likely won't hurt Russia that much. The Kremlin will still earn plenty of profits. An international working group on Russian sanctions recommended a price cap of much lower, $35, to apply severe financial pressure on Moscow. But the fear is that if the price is set too low, Russia won't sell its oil, and then oil prices would skyrocket.
All right. So if the price being most seriously talked about is not much lower than where Russian oil is currently trading, why set this price cap at all?
Well, a $60 cap would represent a modest decrease in average prices over the past several months. And there's a tricky needle to thread here. Like I said, Russia's threatened to cut oil shipments entirely if a price cap is instituted. So the G7 and many EU countries that have big shipping industries want to keep the price high enough to entice Russia to keep selling to the market. Biden administration officials weighed in this week saying that the level of price cap being talked about is meaningful if you look at the average historical price of Russian oil.
So, Carolyn, you mentioned the EU will stop buying most Russian crude on Monday. Is that expected to have a larger impact than a price cap?
Yeah, it is, Marco. That embargo and a similar one coming into effect in early February as seen as the most significant sanctions on Russia to date. In September, about 20% of Russia's crude oil was going to Europe, so the embargo that will take effect Monday will reduce that down to near zero. And then in February, Europe will stop buying diesel fuel and other refined petroleum imports. It's unclear at this point exactly what impact all of this is going to have on oil prices, on oil markets. So it might shape up to be a pretty volatile December.
The World's Carolyn Beeler, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
The first state dinner of the Biden presidency at the White House is happening this evening. The guests, French President Emmanuel Macron, his wife Brigitte Macron, President Biden and First Lady Jill Biden welcomed them this morning. Here's the World's Sarah Birnbaum with more.
the White House pulled out all the stops for the Macrons. Military bands, ceremonial guards, the fife and drum corps. The Macrons pulled up to the south lawn of the White House in a black Suburban with little French and American flags on the front fender. Biden saluted as they got out of the car and then hugs all around. Both leaders made their way to the podium to address the crowd. Biden thanked France.
Our oldest ally, our unwavering partner in freedom's cause.
The two leaders said that partnership is playing out right now in Ukraine.
France and the United States are facing down Vladimir Putin's grasping ambition.
Face au retour de la guerre sur le sol européen.
As war returns to the European soil following Russia's aggression against Ukraine, we need to become brothers in arms once more.
President Biden is hoping to shore up his relationship with Macron, says Mathieu Drouin. He's a career diplomat and a visiting fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Drouin says there was trouble in paradise last year after the U.S. torpedoed France's deal to sell submarines to Australia. In political circles, it's known as the AUKUS affair.
The relations really reached a low last year because of AUKUS, but we have seen that there have been genuine efforts on both sides to repair relations.
Drouin says the Biden administration needs a strong Europe if it's ever going to pivot to Asia. And Macron is a big part of that.
France is the main military power in Europe and also, of course, a nuclear power. So that gives France the credibility and the legitimacy to lead this effort.
State visits and especially the dinners are a big deal. The dinner is the White House's most elaborate social event, and there hasn't been one since 2019 because of COVID. So this French visit is getting a lot of attention in the news here. But in France, it's getting even more attention. Gilles Paris is the former White House correspondent for Le Monde and is now a columnist for the newspaper.
This visit is covered extensively.
Emmanuel Macron se rend la semaine prochaine à Washington pour une.
Paris says it's not just the White House visit and the dinner getting all the attention. It's everything, all the stops along this three-day tour.
We had already the visit at the NASA yesterday.
L'état d'Emmanuel Macron, le siège de la NASA, avec à ses côtés.
You know that on Friday they will travel to New Orleans because of the French origin of the city, of course.
En milieu de semaine à la Nouvelle-Orléans.
And the real state visit, which is today, will be all over the place.
Gilles Paris says the public in France is loving it.
For the French people, it seems that it's showing that Emmanuel Macron is now the leading voice in Europe. The fact that he is doing his second state visit in 4 years is very appreciated in France.
President Donald Trump invited Macron to the White House back in 2018. And Paris says he was there.
What was funny at the time is that France offered Donald Trump a tree. Unfortunately, the tree died. It was a good image of the French attempt to work with Donald Trump.
For this visit, Paris says Macron gave the Bidens copies of the soundtrack of the 1966 French film A Man and a Woman.
And this movie was seen by Joe Biden, and at the time, Jill Tracy Jacobs, for their first date.
He gave them copies on both vinyl and CD. You know, just to be sure. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
You're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/theworld. That's odoo.com/theworld.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Earlier this year in March, world leaders voted at the UN to end plastic pollution worldwide. Today in Uruguay, negotiations for a global plastics treaty are underway. Delegates have 2 years to hammer out a plan. As always, the devil is in the details. Jane Patton is at the conference in Uruguay, the seaside city of Punta del Este. She's with the Center for International Environmental Law. So the treaty calls for ending plastic pollution, not the elimination of plastic use. What does ending plastic pollution mean exactly?
Well, that's a good question, and one we actually haven't worked out within this process yet. You know, this is the first of 5 rounds of negotiation. We have not actually gotten into definitions yet. As of right now, there's an understanding of plastics pollution to be, you know, the visible plastics and trash that is accumulating in the environment, also microplastics in the air. Our mandate for negotiation here specifically mentions the issues of microplastics in the marine environment. But there is a growing understanding, an expanding understanding of what plastic pollution or pollution from plastics actually is.
This is meant to be a global treaty, Jane, but we know plastic waste culminates in different ways across the globe. And as a short-term solution for many, plastic is affordable and makes sense. So how would a worldwide treaty actually work?
Well, I think that's where key provisions of things like financial mechanisms to be able to fund the implementation of the treaty and also technology transfer and technical assistance come in. You know, we're really pushing to make sure that countries are negotiating those financial mechanisms throughout the negotiation sessions and not just sort of tacking it on at the end as an afterthought. But if we're going to be negotiating any kind of provisions, any kind of systems change, any kind of, you know, effective policy solutions to this, the scale of this global plastics crisis, we really have to be talking about how it's financed.
Well, let's zoom out a bit and talk more generally, because there seems to be a back and forth of who should ultimately be responsible for less waste, industries that create plastic or consumers that use it. Who should carry that burden? Is it an either or?
I do think it's both, though I think our understanding of the, quote, consumers that use plastics needs a little bit of updating. For instance, you know, plastics producers really are at the root of this crisis. And of course, you can't talk about plastics producers without talking about their feedstocks, without talking about the oil and gas extractors that are actually, you know, generating natural resources out of which we make this material, that being oil and gas. But then, of course, their customers are not actually you and me. Their consumers are consumer goods companies that in many cases are actually using these plastics as packaging or as delivery systems for the things that they're actually selling. And so at the end of the day, you have to ask yourself, who is the actual consumer of the plastics producers?
2 years from now, Jane, negotiators are supposed to be putting the finishing touches on this global plastics treaty. Briefly, what's your hope?
My hope is that all of us who are working on this treaty can go back to working on something that's not this, right? That we can solve this problem in a way that is supportive of local communities, that is supportive of workers everywhere who are going to be affected by this problem, that we actually have a world or are planning toward a world that is based on reuse and refill, that is not based on single use, that is not based on make-take waste, but really is built on circularity and reuse, but is also protective of human rights.
Jane Patton with the Center for International Environmental Law. She joined us from Punta del Este in Uruguay, where delegates from around the world are starting to outline a new UN-backed global plastics treaty aimed at reducing plastic use and pollution. Jane, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Marco. I'm glad to be here.
40 years ago, the term AIDS entered the medical and social lexicon when the CDC named the disease that had already ravaged some communities, especially the gay community. Today, on World AIDS Day, efforts continue to raise awareness about HIV and AIDS. Dr. Ruben Mayorga is head of HIV, tuberculosis, hepatitis, and sexually transmitted infections at the Pan American Health Organization. He joins us from Washington. Doctor, describe how the rates of HIV infection have changed over the past several years in Latin America and the Caribbean.
Yes. In Latin America, they rose by 5% in regards to 2011. And in the Caribbean, they were reduced by about 28%. So it's a difference. You have an increase in numbers in Latin America as compared to 2010. And you have a reduction in the Caribbean as compared to 2010.
So a drop in the Caribbean, but a rise in infections in Latin America. What accounts for that?
So probably it's because we had better access to prevention interventions in the Caribbean, and we haven't been able to take to a sufficient scale the effective prevention interventions that we can carry out in Latin America. Most of the spending on HIV in the region is directed towards treatment, whereas prevention is mainly funded in many countries by international money from the Global Fund, for example. And in Latin America, less than half of the countries are eligible for funding from the Global Fund.
For those people who are infected, can you generalize about what kind of shape they're in? How are they coping?
In general, we have about a third of people who are diagnosed in Latin America who have late diagnosis. This means they have less than 200 CD4s, which is the measure of immunosuppression. And therefore, these people have a higher possibility of not doing very well with treatment, or have the possibility also of having opportunistic infections that can worsen their prognosis or even take them to death. So we still have a significant percentage of people who are diagnosed at a late stage. And that didn't improve during the pandemic, of course.
Yeah, I mean, as the report shows us, in 2021, 35,000 people lost their lives in the Latin America region from HIV/AIDS. Do you have some hopeful examples of how this is being dealt with at the local level?
Well, yes, there are examples in many South American and Central American countries that are adopting these days their policies regarding self-testing and pre-exposure prophylaxis. So many countries in Latin America and some in the Caribbean are adopting this in these days. And the more of them we have adopting these, the better chances we'll have at prevention. And actually, the Pan American Health Organization provides, for countries that need it, pre-exposure prophylaxis at a price of $4.20 per month per person, if taken continuously. So really, the price of pre-exposure prophylaxis is very affordable to most everybody in the region.
Aside from having this platform of World AIDS Day to shed light on the problem in Latin America, what else needs doing, doctor, as far as reversing the rate of HIV infection across Latin America?
Well, yeah, this is not something that has to be done during World AIDS Day. It has to be done every single day. So one of the strategies that we are following, and this is after the approval of the new global HIV, sexually transmitted infections, and hepatitis strategies at the World Health Assembly in June this year, is the integration of health services so that they are better serving the needs of the populations at risk of HIV, so that you don't have only HIV services at the health center, but other services that are needed by that population. So by tending to other health needs and by, for example, doing the whole series of services that are needed for the prevention and care continuum, we can reverse the ascending trend of cases in the region.
Dr. Ruben Mayorga with the Pan American Health Organization. He spoke with us from Washington. Thanks very much.
Thank you, and a very good afternoon for everybody.
You're with the world. In Barcelona, a new way of commuting to school, the bicycle bus. Kids and parents and a police escort making a convoy to the classroom.
La idea es, pues,
this mom says the idea is to create a festive atmosphere, better than being crammed in buses and cars. And in Qatar, a map to find that elusive bottle of beer still ahead on the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Last year, a reporter in El Salvador noticed her phone was acting weird. It overheated and ran out of batteries too fast. Then, after arranging to meet a source, she arrived to find military officers waiting to question her. She was a reporter at El Faro, a legendary independent newspaper in El Salvador and read across Central America. Soon it became apparent that somebody was breaking into reporters' phones at El Faro using the spyware Pegasus. One of the El Faro reporters who was hacked was an American, Roman Gressier. Now there's a lawsuit against the Israeli spyware company in an American court. Ronan Farrow wrote about this story in The New Yorker. There's a scene in your story, Ronan, where the El Faro newsroom is just finding out how many of them have been hacked and how many times. Describe that moment.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary thing. For instance, you know, the IT person, the salesperson, most of the phones associated with this entire outlet had been compromised. they put up a spreadsheet and kind of walked through and told everyone whose hackings had been confirmed. And a number of the people in that room's virtual room, it was a virtual meeting at the time, said they exchanged kind of texts that were joking to cut the tension, talking about who was the biggest deal, who had merited the most surveillance. But under the surface of that, there was definitely a scramble for people to get back to their notebooks, back to their itineraries, and see, okay, which part of my lives have been compromised.
Yeah, well, one number on that spreadsheet was 42. The executive editor at Alfaro hacked 42 times. That was incredible.
Yeah, and we're talking about hundreds of instances of infection with Pegasus. This is according to Citizen Lab and Amnesty International. Anyone who learns their phone has been totally hijacked thinks of the conversations I'm having with my doctor, the conversations I'm having with my loved ones, anything that could be used against, especially a journalist who's adverse to the government in a country like El Salvador. But then there's an extra layer of, what about my sources? Who's been compromised?
Okay, Ronan, who do the reporters at Alfaro believe was behind the hackings and why?
NSO Group, the manufacturer of Pegasus, says, we're never telling who our secret clients are. The Bukele administration in El Salvador.
Nayib Bukele, the president.
And this is a regime that has come under a lot of scrutiny and criticism for increasingly brazen violations of human rights. And it's also a regime that has been incredibly critical of reporters generally and El Faro, this newsroom we're talking about specifically. But they have gone on the record saying, it's not us, I'm paraphrasing, this is not something that we commissioned, this campaign of hacking.
So when somebody is hacked with Pegasus, there's no dividing line between your business and your personal life. They have access to everything. Why was that significant for this U.S. reporter at El Faro, Roman Gressier?
You know, we're relatively new just as a species to putting so much of our lives in these pieces of technology, phones that are in our pockets and can be turned into listening devices. And in the case of Roman Gressier, the American journalist who was hacked, now is, his lawyers believe, the first American to sue NSO Group in U.S. court. He looked at his phone and his devices afterwards and said he just started panicking for multiple reasons. I mean, for one thing, he's a journalist and he had been incessantly talking on that phone to sensitive sources. And then there was also an extra element of Roman Gressier being bisexual, and this is something he's now public about, but at the time he was only out to close friends and family. And he was working in a country where the LGBT community often does face violent reprisal. And he was keenly aware of, and has since written about, the fact that his sexuality could be weaponized against him.
Mm. The hacking of El Faro journalists, their newsroom, this has all now led to a court case in the U.S. How did that happen?
A number of watchdog groups were watching this situation. And one of those organizations connected the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University, which is a legal clinic that works on free speech issues, to these journalists. And they started talking over recent months about building a piece of impact litigation to try to build stronger guardrails for accountability through case law, saying, you know, we as individuals have sustained damages, and we want a precedent of a court being able to order a company like NSO Group to unmask its clients if they're causing this kind of harm. So it'll be a really interesting test of a mostly untested legal space and the question of what do we allow as a society when this kind of technology is ubiquitous.
Ronan Farrow is a contributing writer for The New Yorker. He wrote about the hacking of reporters in El Salvador and the new lawsuit in an American court against Israel's NSO Group. Ronan, thanks very much.
Thank you so much. Such a pleasure, and appreciate your caring about this. It's important stuff.
A new form of what you could call public transportation has taken root in Spain. It's pure green energy with a major dose of little kid energy. It's called the Bici Bus, which translates as bicycle bus. basically groups of children and parents who take over roads in the morning to pedal to school en masse. It's 50% environment protest, 50% safety measure, and 100% good time. Jerry Haddon reports from Barcelona.
In the years since BC Busing began, the two-wheeled convoys have been starting up all over the city. Today's the maiden voyage of the latest, but this bicycle bus begins in the hills, high above Barcelona. 6 kids and their parents, wearing bright yellow traffic vests, gather with their bikes on a small square. I'm doing this because I don't want to pollute, says 7-year-old Pau Barrios. Pau's mother, Berta Barrios, is one of the chaperones. We're here for a lot of reasons, she says. First, for safety. Second, for the sense of community it offers. We're getting together with other families from the neighborhood, she says. The first leg of their trip to school, a long, winding descent toward Barcelona on a rural road with fast-moving cars. A police escort arrives to block the traffic, and they're off pedaling. 7-year-old Pau's out front for about 7 seconds. An officer orders everyone to stop. He wants them all closer together. If they get too spread out, they're just a bunch of people on bikes. Together, they're a single unit, more like a bus. And cars respect buses more than bikes. Luckily, this morning, the cops have things under control. But there are other challenges for these newbies. The BC Boost turns onto a dirt road. There, it swerves around some startled off-leash dogs and their owners out for their morning strolls. Then the bus stops at a fork in the trail. I'm not sure which way to go, says Barrios, looking around. It's this way to the left, a dad says, downhill. Once unlost, it's down they go. I'm on my supersonic motorcycle, yells Pau. Just about wherever you live now in Barcelona, kids can hop on a BC Bus. They're organized through schools. Same's true in several towns across northeast Spain, where mayors are pushing for fewer cars on the road. Pollution and climate change are serious issues. Still, BC Bus chaperones try to focus on the fun. This is, after all, for kids. Mom Berta Vasquez brings the tunes. She strapped a big speaker to her bike with bungee cords. We play music to create a festive atmosphere, she says, compared to the people crammed together in those cars and buses. This way, she says, the kids get to school fired up. On this four-lane artery, there are cars and buses aplenty. Volunteer Berta Palau says sometimes their police escort is a no-show. When that happens, harried commuters honk at the riders. Let them, she says. This is a protest, even if the impact is small, she says. At least we're no longer a shock to people on the road. She says we become part of the urban landscape. What's not yet part of the urban landscape here? Enough bike lanes. But Barcelona's working on it. It now has over 120 miles worth. It's not Berlin or Copenhagen, but it's adding more each year.
Va, última pujada. Som-hi.
Perfecta. The goal is to get BC buses like these onto dedicated lanes. No need for police. But for now, patrol cars escort them, whether it's down Main Street or down from the mountain. Today's two BC buses reach the gates of a local elementary school at just about the same time. All passengers accounted for. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon in Barcelona.
In Quebec, a message from the premier: you're welcome to move here, but you must speak French. French is the basis of our identity, said François Legault. He wants people from other countries relocating to Quebec for work to speak it. Like many in Quebec, Legault is concerned about the decline of French in the province, especially in the largest city, Montreal. Daniel Billon joins us from Montreal. He's the director of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada. You live in Montreal, Daniel. How much in decline is French in your city and other parts of Quebec? Do you have a memory of how it used to be and how it is now?
Well, you know, there is a lot of anecdotal evidence about the apparent decline of French in Montreal. But, you know, I think we have data from 2021 census that shows that there is a decline of French when we talk about people who speak French as their mother tongue or speak French at home. It's something that you read about a lot in the Francophone media, and that's partly why it has become such a major political issue in the province. But there are different ways you can measure how languages are spoken, and there are different ways to define who is Francophone or Anglophone, who is using French and how. And I think the numbers here can be a bit deceiving, so we have to be careful.
So is this proposal really an attempt to keep French alive as English keeps growing?
That's the way it's framed by the premier. What we have to know about immigration policy in Canada is that the provinces, especially Quebec, play a central role when we talk about economic immigrants. But economic immigrants are only about 65% of immigrants who come to Quebec every year. So François Legault is saying we will increase the proportion of immigrants who speak French from about 80 to 100%. But that's only for economic immigrants because Quebec has control over that category. But then you have 35% of immigrants who are refugees or people who come through what we call family reunification. And these are categories that are controlled really by the federal government. And so the 100% French will only concern economic immigrants, not these two other categories.
I mean, language politics are nothing new in Quebec, but how much different is the discussion around this new proposal, one that creates a language requirement for an economic migrant to even be considered in Quebec?
Well, I think language requirements have long existed, both at the federal level and in Quebec. So speaking French is an asset in terms of people who want to come to Quebec. But there is a difference between that and saying that all the economic immigrants who will come to Quebec will have to already speak French. But it's not that language has not played a major role in immigration policy in Quebec. It has played a major role since there was this devolution of immigration policy towards economic immigrants back in 1991. But the scope of what he's talking about is, of course, unprecedented to say it will be 100%.
Right. I mean, how would this proposal actually become the law of the land? Walk us through its chances.
Well, we will see how it goes. There might be some pushback from people in the business sector because Quebec right now has very low unemployment and labor shortages in some regions and areas of the economy. So there are trade-offs here, right, between this kind of cultural language imperative on the one hand and then economic incentives and factors. We talk here about economic immigrants, and immigration is perceived by many people in Canada and in Quebec as being something legitimate, that we are an immigration country. Is the idea that immigrants contribute to the economy. Of course, Francophone immigrants also contribute to the economy. But if it becomes this factor above everything else, there are people who might think that from an economic standpoint might not be a wise policy. It limits the pool of immigration candidates.
Do you see this as xenophobia kind of masquerading as language protection?
There is a real anxiety about the survival of French in Quebec that even predates massive immigration or large-scale immigration. But it's true that now, in at least the discourse of some politicians and journalists and columnists, that immigration and fears about language mesh. And so I think that this discourse can lead to reinforcing prejudice towards immigrants, because many immigrants actually learn French. They want to learn French, improve their French. And so I think that some of this discourse can be problematic and might not be helpful in terms of actually convincing people to improve their French. And so it might be actually counterproductive altogether.
Daniel Bellon is the director of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada at McGill University in Montreal. Daniel, for this, it seems appropriate to say merci beaucoup, directeur. Thanks very much.
Merci à vous. Thank you very much.
At the Men's World Cup of Soccer in Qatar,
it is officially over as we welcome those that were watching Belgium and Croatia. Morocco not only advances, Kobe, they win the group.
Morocco has become the only Arab nation to advance past the first round. Just a few more matches to go before the round of 16 and knockout stage start this weekend. Fans in Qatar have been packing the stadiums, 94% capacity for each match. According to FIFA, soccer's governing body, more than 3 million tickets sold. From the sounds of things, despite the criticism of the event, the fans are having a blast. All that excitement and no beer in sight. Qatar tightly regulates alcohol sales and consumption. Public drunkenness is illegal there. And recall what happened just 2 days before the World Cup began. Qatar pulled the ultimate bouncer move, reneging on a promise to serve beer at stadium sites. So many fans have been doing the pre-gaming thing.
We'll get a couple extra shots in right before we leave, so you do put a little more effort into to the pregame.
That'd be shots of alcohol, not shots on goal, explains Ed Ball, an aerospace salesman from Seattle. He's in Qatar now, cheering on Team USA. Before he left for Doha, Ball had spent months creating the Qatar Alcohol Map. It's a Google map that shows licensed hotels, restaurants, and bars legally serving alcohol. He compiled it through word of mouth.
People in the U.S. supporter groups had actually lived in Qatar or visited. They're like, hey, at this hotel. Hey, at this hotel.
Ball verified the information.
I contacted every single bar, restaurant, hotel on there.
Now he says nearly 200 establishments are on the list. It is blowing up, more than 700,000 views and counting.
I've gotten some good comments from people from, you know, from England, Wales, Mexico, Argentina.
Ball says the map does not skirt around Qatar's laws regarding alcohol consumption. On the contrary, he says the idea behind the list was to provide people with information so they could respect the culture and laws. And yeah, get a drink. We're going to look at what the United Nations is calling its annual campaign of activism against gender-based violence. That campaign is happening now, and I should warn you that the content of this next story may not be suitable for all listeners. One target of the UN's campaign, female genital mutilation, or FGM. The ancient practice has long been thought to curb women's sexual desires and ensure their virginity until marriage. It's still performed in many parts of the globe. Journalist Alexa Dvorzin first reported on FGM in the West African nation of the Gambia in the 1990s. She recently went back to learn about the progress of a movement to halt the practice. Again, take care while listening.
First, a haunting flashback. In 1995, I accompanied a small team of anti-FGM activists to meet a girl who almost bled to death after a botched procedure to cut off her clitoris. She'd been rushed from her village to a health center near Banjul, the Gambian capital. The group was led by Ami Juf, a women's rights advocate.
We will try as much as possible not to make it sensational. We will use it to make people more aware, to create consciousness, but not to create a conflict situation.
Since complications from FGM were almost never reported, the group hoped that documenting the case would strengthen its rural outreach campaign.
How old are you? How old are you? Good English.
She's smiling a little bit. The girl, named Mai, wasn't sure of her age. We guessed 7 or 8. From her hospital bed, she told us how she and other girls had been lured into the circumciser's hut with an offer of bananas. It was 6 days after her ordeal, and she'd only just been able to walk again. Ami Juf and Imam Babali still remember that March morning all too well.
She was a living example of the practice that went bad.
It was a very painful event and memory I cannot forget.
Ami Juf and the Imam are founding members of GAMKOTRAP, the Gambia Committee on Traditional Practices, which has campaigned against FGM since the mid-1980s. For Imam Babali, the encounter at the clinic struck close to home. His own sister was circumcised as a girl, and though she later had children of her own, she died in childbirth due to lingering complications from FGM. His exposure to the tradition goes back even further. When he was 5, he lived with one of his great aunts, a circumciser.
I used to tell her, what are you doing to these young girls? It's not good, it's not fair. I can hear their cries, their howling, calling for help. I was naturally very uncomfortable with that.
The near death of the girl we met at the clinic led to a frank discussion between her mother and the community elders about the dangers of FGM. That resulted in a decision to ban the practice there, with several neighboring villages following suit. Despite some setbacks, Ami Juf thinks the anti-FGM campaign in the Gambia has made progress since then.
Now that GAMKOTRAP and other organizations have developed this strategy of working with young people, working with the schools, the belief is that when people are informed, information is power. And knowledge allows you to make informed choices, informed decisions.
These days, whole communities are involved in the effort that includes a 2-year program to raise awareness among the circumcisers and retrain them in alternative occupations. The process culminates in a public declaration ceremony called Dropping of the Knives. At the most recent one last June, a local leader summed up his community's resolve.
We come to an agreement that those who are the head of these practitioners should drop their knives to stop these brutal acts.
Since 2007, over 1,000 rural communities have taken part, including more than 200 circumcisers. At the high point of the ceremony, they assemble to drop their razor blades on a cloth for everyone to see. Dressed in red to symbolize the blood-soaked suffering they'd inflicted, they take an oath to abandon FGM for good.
The impact that we have made today is that we have been able to bring in young activists, women-led organizations, male involvement. I'm proud of you girls and boys.
Aissatou Touré is Gamcotrap's executive director and former vice president of the Gambia. At a recent meeting of the UN's Sexual and Reproductive Health Agency, she said her country is on track to meet UNICEF's global goal to abandon FGM by 2030.
People must get the information right. So all that we need to do is to educate, communicate, and then engage with them. Let us not just sit in the offices and say we are fighting FGM.
According to a UNICEF study, the more educated girls and women are, the less likely they'll approve of FGM. Activist Ami Diouf has witnessed this firsthand.
If you talk to some of those young women, you will hear them say things like, "What has been done to me? I will not allow."
That's what a 29-year-old woman told me. She chose the name Nena for this story, speaking on condition that neither her real name nor her voice would be used. Her words are spoken by an actor.
"I am the youngest when it comes to the women in my family. All of us have gone through FGM. Some of my sisters have daughters, but they will not be cut. Our parents, my mom and stepmom, cannot force us to put our children through it. There's nothing they can do to convince us."
FGM was outlawed in the Gambia in 2015, but women determined to uphold the tradition may skirt the law by sending their daughters to neighboring countries to have them cut. While precise data on the current incidence of FGM here are hard to come by, Gamcotrap's research suggests rates are declining. At this wedding engagement party, one of the many blessings bestowed on Awa Gomez, the bride-to-be, is the wish that she'll bear many healthy children. She typifies her generation's attitude toward FGM.
"I didn't go through that process, and no baby girl of mine will be circumcised. Absolutely not. I think it's a practice that's kind of heinous. It's something very inhumane to do. I think most Gambians right now have stopped doing that."
Women's rights activists in the Gambia have long maintained that forcing change doesn't work. They say the best approach is patience, persuasion, and persistence. For the world, this is Alexa DeVorsen, The Gambia.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.